Hello and welcome to the new edition of TLS Voices. My name is Stig Abel, editor of the Times Literary Supplement. I'm joined as ever by commissioning editor and work-shy invalid Thea Leonard-Dutsey. How are you feeling, Thea?
I shall have you know that I actually received concerned phone calls after last week. So I think that's not because of what I said so much as how I said it.
You weren't well, and then no. You got home and were very ill, weren't you?
I was very, very ill. My voice in last week's show, should anyone care to listen, reached depths that no woman's voice has ever reached before.
And it was a sign of impending doom for you. But you're feeling
so
better now?
Yes, I fixed my bed. I'm feeling
no coughing fits?
Perhaps. We'll see.
Okay.
I'll do my best.
We will do our best. Before we get to the show, I want to tell you a way to get a cheap subscription to the TLS. If you simply Google TLS subscriptions, type pod1 in the offer code tab, you can get 6 issues for £6. And I should remind you that if you want to support this podcast, please do review us on iTunes. We really do welcome that, especially, but not only, if you're very nice. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be discussing women on horseback with Jerry Kimber, the role of women in the rise of the Western. We've also sent our consulting editor on the arts, Anna Vo, out to the David Hockney exhibition at the Tate Britain. It's fastest ever selling arts show, I believe. Anna has been talking to Andrew Wilson, one of the curators. And finally, we'll be exploring that small and insignificant question as to what makes a successful book. Daisy Hilliard will give us all the answers. One of the great myths in America is that of the lonesome cowboy, stubbled and austere, fighting evil against the glinting backdrop of a hard scrabble landscape, a kind of epitome of maleness. But as Jerry Kimber sees in her review of 3 books set in the American world of the Gilded Age, women were instrumental in the story of Westerns. First, female authors led the drive for improved quality in Western novel writing at the turn of the 19th century, trying to reclaim the genre from dime novel pulp fiction. The first quality Western, the Administratics, it's a very strange title, the Administratics, was written by a suffragist from Colorado called Emma Gent Curtis in 1889, 13 years before Owen Wister wrote The Virginian, widely held to be the model for the reinvented genre and a very good novel. 2. So what precisely is the female influence on this purportedly masculine genre? And speaking of women with guns, we may also get into another book Jerry reviews, the story of a bloody murder by the notorious Mrs. Clem. Jerry Kimber joins Thea and me now. Tell us, because I remember reading The Virginian, I really liked it, I read it in college, but I'd never heard of the Administratics before. What's it like? Tell us about that.
It was one of the most important books written by a female concerning the Western, but the most important one for me was the novel Kojewi by Mourning Dove.
Okay, tell us about that.
She was one of the very first Native American women to have a book published. I think there were only 2 before her. There was a female protagonist, which was unusual in itself. She portrayed mixed race relationships and marriage, which had taken place ever since, you know, the Westerners had gone to conquer the West. Pretty Native American girls were very often taken up by the conquering European males. This book was absolutely groundbreaking in its importance for showcasing an indigenous culture, using the genre of the Western, which was so male West, you know, male dominated, and in particular dominated by a European tradition, which had nothing to do with the Native Americans.
That was true even when it was written by women. I mean, one of the striking things from your review, that even though there were female novelists, they were tending to write novels about male heroes, where they might comment on the difficulty of the life for Western women, but it wasn't really seeking to sort of break the mould too much. Is this an exception?
No, not at all. They were centred around their own culture and gender expectation. That was their war. Their war was never about the vicious cruelty being perpetrated upon the indigenous peoples of America. They had their own axes to grind, and that was about gender inequality and class to a certain extent as well. And it was only with Mourning Dove's novel that, from a fiction point of view, started to think about the role of the Native American in such novels.
Did Mourning Dove sort of problematise the racial opposition there? Did she sort of create more sympathetic characters?
She did. It was the title of the book was Kojewi, the Half Blood. You know, it was so even from the title itself, it's that sort of white man notion, isn't it? Of I'm sure the Native Americans didn't call themselves half bloods. That was a sort of a Western fixation on what they had become, half bloods. It's the plight of the mixed blood or breed, as they were also known. Yeah. Who live in both white and Indian cultures. Many Native Americans had Indian mothers and white fathers. That was quite common. And that began even before the conquering of the West with fur traders, trappers, other explorers.
Is it a good novel, Jerry? I mean, is it one of those? I mean, was it influential, or was it just, did it end up a curiosity, of an exception?
No, absolutely the latter. Much more of a curiosity. It's only Victoria Lamont has done a lot to reinvigorate this tradition and to reinvigorate Mourning Dove and other writers like her. Who were trying to do something with the Western from a feminist perspective, which most of us never think about that. You know, it's such a male-dominated, testosterone-driven genre that we barely think about any role that females might have had in perpetrating the genre.
You mentioned in the piece also Annie Oakley, a sort of rodeo cowgirl, and you say they're seen as the first ever female athletes. If we're thinking of the West as someone which is kind of male-dominated in a particular type of macho world, how do rodeo cowgirls fit into that world?
Because they had freedom. In my review, I talk about how a lot of women at this time, when Westerners were colonising the West and taking it away from the indigenous peoples, the lot of women was dire. I mean, the lot of the men wasn't much better, but the women had almost no agency. They cooked, they cleaned, they grew vegetables. It was a hard life. But then you have these women, sharpshooting in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, and they were. As the book explains, they were feminized versions of the Western male hero. They became heroines, and boy, did they have agency. They wore glamorous costumes. They traveled not only America, but the world, because Buffalo Bill's Wild West show did come to Europe, and they led a very glamorous life, and they were also very fit. You know, they were bareback horse riding. They were doing all sorts, to that surprising extent that they were known as the first group of professional women athletes in North America.
Well, let's talk about another woman who perhaps was judged differently for her attempt to be independent, because the third book that you review is about Mrs. Nancy Clem, who was a beautiful, fascinating and clever woman, and perhaps therefore was caught up in this double murder of Jacob and Nancy Young in 1868. What do you take from the story? It became a sort of notorious case, didn't it?
It did become, nationally notorious. It was, people could, during its height, people talked of very little else. You know, one of the most horrific things ever to happen, in the history of the world, I think there was one headline, which was rather enthusiastic and a little, over-exaggerated.
Good headline.
But it was very strange. You know, even now, no one really knows what happened. That no one knows if Mrs. Clem was guilty or innocent. You know, and
she was acquitted. I mean, she was tried, wasn't she? And she was acquitted.
Four times she was tried. She was found guilty on one of the trials and did spend some time in prison. But she had very good lawyers who then fought her cause, and she was eventually acquitted.
Much of the fascination around her, though, wasn't even so much to do with the crime, so much as to do with the fact that this was a woman who was...
Exactly. And we're back, we're Yeah, we're back to that idea of the role of women again. Mrs. Clem ran a sort of very covert brokerage service, borrowing money from people who had it, offering them very high interest rates, lending it to other people, again, at high interest rates. But the whole thing was unsustainable. When the people who had loaned her the money wanted it back with interest rates, sometimes she was able to give it, other times she refused. And, you know, it was a system that was always going to crash. And one of her, she had two male partners. And when Jacob Young realised that he was in way over his head, he took about $9,000 in notes and ran off with his wife, but he only got a few miles away. And he was found the next day, brutally murdered. He'd been shot in the head. His wife had also been shot with a different gun and burnt from the sort of neck downwards. It was a really gruesome murder.
And even and this remove, what does the person who wrote the book think? Is it the view that she did it or that she didn't? What's the prevailing
I don't think Wendy Gambert, it's impossible. I mean, it's a brilliant book. I thoroughly recommend it. But I don't think that she could really form a conclusion because there isn't enough evidence. The evidence was a footprint that had been found. But that was it. The evidence was so flimsy that it was hard. There was some slight circumstantial evidence, and it was clearly what she was doing was wrong and illegal, but that wasn't what she was being tried for. She was being tried for a murder, and the evidence for that was just too slim.
Is it simplistic to say, to a certain extent, she was being tried for being a woman trying to enter what
yep.
would have been an extraordinarily male world of not only business but money lending? So you're in a male society anyway, and then you're in a particularly male branch of that society. Do you think that was clearly a factor in all this?
It was almost the only factor. Nobody could believe that a woman could be number one, tried for murder, but number two, tried for murder because, you know, there are always these cases of crimes of passion, etc., etc., but tried for murder to do with business, financial business. You know, it was unheard of, and that was her downfall, really, and why she was so vilified for such a long time, was that she was going against the grain of American society. Women didn't do what Mrs. Clem did. But it was so in her blood, she couldn't not be what she was.
Mm, there's a line from one of the prosecutors in the case that sort of sums up the mood, really. And it's financial dealings violated her marriage contract, thereby rendering her capable of the worst act. So it's almost her crime was basically the crime of not acting like a lady, which is in this context
exactly.
is seen as a fast track to becoming a murderer.
But even when she was finally acquitted and she was able, to sort of go out into the big wide world, she was soon lending and borrowing again. It was, you know, unbelievable. You'd think that she would have learned her lesson. And then finally ending up as Mrs. Dr. Patterson, purporting to be a doctor, peddling the most obnoxious lotions and potions, one of which led to a man's death. She got away with that as well. She was incarcerated in prison for larceny for some other dodgy financial dealings, but got away with the murder of this man and eventually died. And then after her death, all her sort of miscreant life was brought back up to the fore and sensationalised in the press again.
Someone
it's
needs to make
a
film
life.
About this life. If they haven't already, somebody needs to do that.
Well, they should. I one thing I did want to bring up in the review, but there wasn't really space for it, and it was sort of slightly off topic, was in that with to do with the gun, you know, that gun, the one that won the West, the Winchester, was that one of the family members ended up creating this very famous house in California, which some people may have actually
been to. Oh, the Winchester Mansion.
You've been, the Winchester
been.
Mystery House,
yeah.
Which I had heard of. Now, it's a place I've always wanted to go to. It absolutely fascinates me, this idea of 24,000 square feet of 160-room mansion built over 38 years by a woman who was absolutely convinced that the fortunes of her husband's family, because he was a Winchester. He died young of tuberculosis. Their daughter had died as a child. of an illness, and that all the their misfortune was to do with the bad luck, because the Winchester money had been built on murder, you know, not just the murder of white people, but the murder of the indigenous peoples, and that to atone for this, a spirit medium had said to her, keep building. If you move to the West and build a house and never finish it, they will not come for you. And that's what she did.
Tell you what, Jerry, it's been you've uncovered some fascinating stories. I mean, it probably is indicative of the West, isn't it? That it is a part of the world, and it's part of history that is brimful of kind of fascinating curiosities.
Absolutely, it's you know, and I hope it sort of will reinvigorate it, because we don't really watch black and white westerns on TV anymore, or Bonanza or the High Chaparral that some of us as tiny tots grew up on. But you know, it was massive, and I hope these books have done something to sort of reinvigorate it. Yeah,
that's a great point. Well, Jerry, thank you so much for doing writing the review and for joining us today.
The Winchester Mansion is
it cool?
It is. So she's so strange.
So she's not allowed to finish it.
Well, so I mean, when I went,
you sound tuberculotic yourself.
Only slightly. It's fine. It's not. I don't think I'm contagious anymore.
Typhoid tears.
But at the mansion, the guide was saying that it wasn't so much that she was told that she must never finish it. It was that she was building all of these annexes and additions to the house, to sort of throw the ghosts of those that they had killed over the years off course. So you'll open a cupboard and there's a half a staircase, or, you know, a staircase to fool the ghosts. And she would every night sleep in a different part of the house so that they would never find her.
Just when you think the gun history of America can't get any stranger, yeah. It always does, isn't it? Everything about guns in America is ultimately puzzling, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's just an extraordinary thing that, A, the feeling that they've... correctly feeling that her fortune comes from the death of people. And then now the fact that guns are still so fetishized in America. And you know, the stats always get, but 30 people are murdered every year by armed toddlers in America. I know it gets used a lot, but it's still
shocking.
It is still effectively astonishing, isn't
it?
And this Western thing we've been talking about, the Western myths, the idea of the rugged individual man who has to sort of protect, there's a bit of kind of Emersonian transcendentalism, self-reliance in it. There's a bit of, but it's based on the ability to defend your lands, to push ever westward, to take what you think is yours. And that's a very resonant myth, isn't it?
Yeah, and I wonder how transferable it is. We ran out of time there with Jerry, but I know that she's written about Catherine Mansfield and Janet Frame, so there's a New Zealand connection. And I wondered whether other places that had a similar history had a similar literary flourishing as well. So, say, in New Zealand, where you've got the West Coast, and they had a gold rush and these wild frontier towns and indigenous peoples who were killed. And
And Australia as well.
And Australia, yes. I don't know, answers on a postcard or something. But, I mean, I'd love to know whether the Western tradition is replicated.
Frontier
the
literature, how global is frontier literature? Yeah, we should look into that. That's a great point. We have to move on. The painter David Hockney is being honoured by a retrospective at the Tate Britain, tracing his career from the early sketches of the 1960s to previously unseen new paintings. It is the fastest-selling exhibition in the gallery's history, with 20,000 advanced tickets sold. So we thought we'd send our consulting editor on the arts, Anna Vo, to the Tate to nose around and report back on this most celebrated and commercial of British artists. She's also talking here to one of the exhibition's curators.
Can you tell me how you've curated this? How are you hoping we're going to experience it? How's the show unfolding? Where are we standing now?
Okay, we're standing in the first room. And in a way, this is a room to orientate the visitor, because as an artist who's worked in an incredibly diverse way, a huge variety of approaches to picture making and use of media, which unfold chronologically, in a sense, so where the show is a very straightforward chronological walk through the last 60 years of his career. The first room, in a sense, asks the question, well, what is at the core of this? what is at the core of his work.
So these
paintings dated from 1963, so the early 60s, the early 70s, mid to late 70s, and a recent work from 2014, I think.
And it's called Play Within a Play, this room.
It is, which takes the title from a 1963 painting of his dealer, John Casman, which is called Play Within a Play. And
do you want to describe what's going on?
Yes, absolutely. So here we've got an image of a man with his hands held up, pressed against a sheet of perspex.
Oh, yes.
And it derives from a photograph of Casman pressed against the glass door of his gallery in Bond Street. And he stands, however, in an impossibly shallow space between the glass and the tapestry, with the chair beside him. And the tapestry behind him, in a way, is playing on a number of things. A curtain appears in a large number of David Hockney's works through the 60s, very much as a signal for a theatre of representation, you know, sort of the play of artifice. In a way, it stands as one sign for the act of representation. And here, the curtain is a tapestry. It may be even a theatre curtain, a drop curtain perhaps, or a flat even, though it's got tassels around it. And on the tapestry is a landscape with figures. There's a what looks like a solid rainbow casting a shadow, which is a bit strange. And there's elongated figures. Through the 60s, he paints a number of figures almost as hieratic kind of ancient monuments.
Well, she looks very Egyptian.
Very Egyptian or Assyrian, yeah. But this idea of, you know, a shallow layering of different kinds of reality. You've got the real material of perspex.
Right.
Casman pressed against it.
Well, he looks very trapped.
Very trapped, and his hands and nose and the bottom of his jacket are brushing against the perspex, leaving an imprint. And the imprint, however, is on our side of the perspex. It's not underneath, it's on our side.
Can you show me how this is picked up in the...
Sure. I mean, basically, what if we look at this painting, which is a painting ostensibly of David Hockney drawing at his table.
I should say we're still in the same.
We're still in the same room. We're still in the first room.
Anyway.
We've just moved across from one wall to the other.
But this is painted when?
This is painted in 1977, and it's a painting of his boyfriend Gregory Evans asleep on a divan in the studio, and we see David Hockney drawing behind the figure. So it's sort of almost as if you'd expect David Hockney to actually, if he's picturing his boyfriend, to be where we are. But actually, this is a painting of a painting.
We've stumbled on a very private moment looking at his boyfriend him drawing.
Mm.
In spite of all the colour, it's an incredibly quiet picture.
Mm.
So we are very intimately involved.
Yes. And I think that in very many different ways he draws us into his work. Okay, so the second room...
But this is very unexpected.
Suddenly plunges us into a world of abstraction.
And a very different colour palette.
A very different, very muted, very browns and greys and creamy off-whites. And a painting that looks like a form of abstract expressionism. An abstract expressionism that owes as much to British and European painters such as Alan Davy, Roger Hilton, or European artists like Jean Dubuffet, as much as to American abstract expressionism. And yet it's, you look closely as this develops, and you see letters appearing, and then words appearing. And what this evolves into is a form of subversion of the abstraction, and the abstraction takes on other meanings to do with his own sexuality, essentially. You know, these have become paintings that he described at the time as propaganda for homosexuality. And, you know, these are the paintings that he was first really well known for. And their paintings, I mean, it's like looking at this, the painting We Two Boys Together Clinging, takes, you know, it's a poem by Walt Whitman.
Yes.
It's also a title that comes from a newspaper cutting that he found, the story about two boys cling together on cling together on cliff, and it's about two boys that were trapped on a cliff and had to be rescued from a cliff. But to David Hockney, who had a crush at the time on Cliff Richard, it had other connotations. There's this very simple kind of coding going on, 4-2, which stands.
These are numbers in the left hand
corner.
Corner painted in so, white, 4.2.
4.2, and 4 is A, B, C, D, and 2 is B. DB, Dollboy, so Cliff Richard. And here is 4-8, which is CR. Which is, so this number is on one of the figures. In fact, it's on the figure twice. And so in a way, he's inscribing his own desires into this painting. The title, in a sense, clings to, you know, acts as an arm drawing the two figures together, and one also clings to the other. And in a way, it's sort of very, very, I think, in a way, courageous, because, I mean, this is, you know, homosexuality was illegal at the time. I mean, there's...
Let's have a look at this painting.
Okay.
California Art Collector.
1964. So it's a painting of a generic art collector surrounded by a range of art. Well, a sculpture that may be a sort of William Turnbull sculpture, and a sort of Egyptian or Easter Island kind of sculptural head in a canopied enclosure with a sort of rug or shag pile carpet and an armchair, a solid rainbow. I mean, I think already the way in which Hockney was fascinated by the question of how you paint colour, which is light. So how do you paint light? How do you paint water? And you paint glass, these sort of insubstantial but very substantial things that are not solid, not always changing. And I think that, you know, this is a moment when, you know, sort of there's a sort of tip starts to happen between an art that's formed largely from imagination to an art that's very much about observation. I mean, All of these works are in this room fluctuating in different ways between imagination and observation. So, Man in a Museum or You're in the Wrong Movie, the painting to the left there, and also the first Marriage and Marriage of Styles, you know, a title which actually describes Hockney's work throughout, this idea of a marriage of styles being almost archetypal postmodern artist. Both of them were had their source in seeing a friend walking around a museum and seeing him standing next to, you know, in the Egyptian room or whatever, with a sculpture or a mummy or what have you, and thinking, gosh, that's an interesting relationship. And I think when we go into the next room, we'll see how that shifts looking forward towards the double portraits, where the subject of the work becomes not only, you know, the urge towards a new form of naturalism, but also making a painting that is about relationships, and so you know, an emotional spark between the two people depicted, but also between David Hockney as the third participant.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
In the relationship, which is us.
Yeah. Thea, where do you stand on Hockney? Is he important to you? Is he important to the country, to the world?
I was about to say I own a few Hockneys, but of course I don't. I own a few Hockney prints. I definitely want to go and see this show. I think I will probably be disappointed. I'm not a huge fan of his later work.
Not many people are, I don't think.
Yeah, I really like his sketches, his portraits from the 70s. His portraits of Celia, I think they're quite beautiful. And then I love his photographic portraits from the 80s, I suppose, of Gregory. And
yeah.
I think that's where, for me, he was strongest. And I don't really go for all the iPad stuff.
No, the iPad stuff is utterly baffling to me, because it does look, you know, my daughter has an iPad thing that she draws on, and the problem is it's just thick lines.
I understand it as this is a clever critique of or work against work or whatever. I can understand the theory behind why it's interesting, but I still don't like it.
But this will be big for the Tate, won't it?
It will be absolutely huge. I mean, yeah, it will blow all of their...
And they'll make some money.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. They'll make an absolute fortune, because I can't think of anyone who has as big a position in British art.
There's probably not a living... I wonder if there's a living artist that they would that could rival him for this level of commercial attention.
Yeah,
it's hard to say.
Probably not, because he unites so many people. You know, high, low, whatever.
And he's been around.
Been around, and he's had a very interesting life. And he's very present. He quite often will comment on things like, you know, the smoking ban or whatever. Yeah. So he's a figure who is relevant to many people.
And there's kind of culture wars around him because there's issues around, presumably in the 80s and 70s, when being gay was more of an issue. He was a figure for that, and working class background set against sort of, so there's a kind of a class issues that surround him. He's very modern in that sense, isn't he?
Yeah.
Well, it's on at the minute. You may be able to get a ticket, but certainly lots of other people have got there before you. From a best-selling artist, then, to best-selling fiction, Daisy Hildyard has reviewed a number of books that ask the question, what constitutes successful writing? The main proponent of this question is the Bestseller Code, which uses literary analytics, computer-based research, to establish what makes certain books succeed and others fail. Here's a flavour. Bestsellers use do, but not very. Didn't instead of did not. intimacy sells, explicit sex does not. Bestsellers use question marks and avoid exclamation marks. Poor Donald Trump. Appealing, proactive characters and a regularly pulsing plot are marketable, it says. Which may suggest its specialised subject is the bleeding obvious.
I'm still happy to hear about the exclamation mark.
Yeah, there should be no one should ever use an exclamation mark. I think that should just be written in stone. Elsewhere in the review, we hear from DBC Pierre, who opines that writing is heavy bombing. Make of that what you will. And from Jane Austen, who is set up as an exemplum of successful style. So what makes a book critically or commercially successful? And before we welcome Daisy, I just wanted to read out something from the afterword of Lolita, in which Nabokov recalls some commercial advice he received, which is one of my favourite things ever. This is what he says. One reader suggested that his firm might consider publication if I turned my Lolita into a 12-year-old boy and had him seduced by Humbert, a farmer, in a barn, amidst gaunt and arid surroundings. All this set forth in short, strong, realistic sentences. He acts crazy. We all act crazy, I guess. I guess God acts crazy. Possibly the worst piece of publishing advice ever recorded in print. Daisy joins us now. So you've ploughed through some relatively challenging stuff here. Is it possible to use literary analysis to predict a bestseller, do you think?
The authors of the bestseller code think that it is. And they set out their very definite prescription for doing so.
So how would that work, do you think?
Well, I suppose much of what they're looking at is, at its kind of most ambitious, is a comment on the human condition and what kind of deep desires we have. You know, why do we like to read books about young women being murdered, for example, or books with the girl in the title?
Is this depressing and soul-destroying, or is this just sort of the progress of modernity? Because there's a kind of thing happened in American sports, which was broadly similar. There's a load of people who said, well, you can't quantify talent, and you can only judge talent by scouts who've been there before. So there's a kind of tradition of experience is the real key to everything. And then people came and said, no, we can use statistical analysis and we can quantify exactly what makes a good player and what doesn't. There's a real sort of cultural clash between those two sides of the argument. Is something similar liable to happen here, where you can say, look, we can quantify a successful book. Whether we can quantify a good book might be a different point. Do you think this is where this is headed?
I think certainly people are going to try to quantify a good book, and that there'll be a kind of sense of a clash of civilizations. I suppose it will be about finding someone interesting who is able to read the statistics in an interesting way and draw interesting conclusions from them. And you know, that might be a way which, you know, to find new writing.
Because you would get to a point where the thing was to work against the kind of agreed formula, and that's what would make great literature, would be working against the established formula.
But I think in films, I remember reading an interview with Will Smith, the Hollywood actor, and when he was trying to make his career work, he sat down with his agent and they looked at the top 100 best film, the most successful films of the last 10 years, and they tried to draw parallel. One of the things is, so Aliens is popular, so he made Men in Black. Westerns was popular, so he made Wild West. And he actually just, they sat down and kind of formulated a criteria. And I presume that's what publishers do to a certain extent. That's why when 50 Shades of Grey is published, you then get a slew of other to kind of tap that's kind of trying to follow on from that. It's probably always been that way, hasn't it?
Well, 50 Shades of Grey is an interesting example because it slightly contradicts Archer and Jocker's thesis that explicit sex doesn't sell. And they have to do some kind of, I would say, perhaps contorted readings in order to justify why 50 Shades did work. It was a surprise.
You also reviewed the Jane Austen Writers Club by Rebecca Smith. What advice did you get from Austen from Beyond the Grave, and did the setup of the book work for you?
The setup of the book was questionable for me in that I felt that there was a great deal of quotation from Austen and not much from Smith. So I felt that I was really enjoying reading some of Austen's letters and notes, but that there wasn't so much transition between reading Austen and seeing how the way in which she wrote could be useful to novice writers. I think this is a book very much for people who are tentative about writing.
Jane Austen's very trendy at the minute. Obviously, it's the bicentennial. I suppose anything that sends people back to Austen's broadly a good thing, but you can't necessarily...
No one's ever left her. I mean, she's perpetually
there, yeah. But you can't distill any advice that comes out of us to think, oh, that would make me write in a different way.
Well, I wouldn't say this is advice, but I think the thing that I most enjoyed was the sense that one shouldn't take any of it too seriously.
I think Austin's an interesting one in this context as well, isn't she? Because she comes from a time, she represents a time very much pre-modernism, when good plots and the things that one might associate with, you know, genre fiction or whatever, and literary acuity were not considered to be mutually exclusive.
Absolutely.
The final one that you did is Alchemy, Writers on Truth, Lies and Fiction. Where does this fit into to the other books? Was this the useful thing?
I don't think it would be a useful book for people who are looking for practical advice on writing. It's a book, it's a very deeply reflective and searching book. All the authors are reflecting on their own writing history, really, rather than writing practice, their kind of feelings and thoughts about writing.
Daisy, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I wonder, Thea, do writers know what makes good writing?
I think a more interesting question is how would they define what is good? How would they define what is success? I mean, I think all of these books here, you kind of almost feel like they should be appended with George Orwell's essay, you know, why I write.
Yeah.
Because how can you define, I mean, is it would making a lot of money be success, or would people talking about it be success?
Well, I think, and I think the bestseller code, I suspect, as Daisy kind of implied, the bestseller code is commercial. Mm. And writers on truth, lies and fiction, I suspect, is a little bit more self-indulgent,
yes,
sort of talking about truth and beauty. My favourite advice for writing, have you read Elmore Leonard's Rules for Writing?
No.
It's brilliant. There's 10 rules for writing he wrote. It begins with, first rule is never begin a book with weather, which I think is brilliant. And it ends with, if it sounds like writing, I rewrite it. That's his summary of all rules. It's thing, and I just wonder whether you can clearly never be prescriptive,
mm-hmm.
but you become a better writer, don't you, by reading good writing,
yeah.
Not necessarily good writing about writing.
Mm-hmm. Well, who was it? Was it William Faulkner who said about how to become a writer, just read everything, read the good stuff, the bad stuff,
yeah.
read trash, and
yeah.
you know, then like a carpenter, whatever doesn't work, you throw out at
yeah.
the end of the day and get on with it. And I think that's probably the school of writing that is prevailing at the moment. I would think people seem to read so widely, and you know, since the much talked about boundary between genre fiction and literary fiction collapsed years ago, and was
yeah.
sort of dancing on the space where it once was. People draw from all different sources.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think well-written genre fiction has a sort of beauty.
Mm, and it's the stuff that's doing best now, you know, from Sarah Perry to Kate Atkinson,
yeah,
Cormac
yeah.
McCarthy, that would all be...
Yeah, Cormac McCarthy's a very good example of
yeah.
that, which is just there, just slightly elevated. James Elroy probably is another example.
Yeah.
It's just slightly elevated genre fiction, and that, yeah, and that is very successful. It's interesting. I suspect the answer is, once you get too prescriptive, you start to kill it. Yeah,
mm.
That's probably something in that. That's almost all we have time for this week. Thanks to Jerry Kimber, the intrepid Anna Vo, and Daisy Hildyard. Let me remind you to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back every week this year with thoughts on big pieces in the TLS and important cultural and artistic issues. This week's paper is now on sale with the pieces we have been discussing, plus Gillian Tyndall on 2,000 Years of Spitalfields, Marjorie Perloff on the scribblings of Cy Twombly, Candida Baker on The Age of the Horse, which has kind of weirdly split the TLS offices there, because George, who works with us, he hates horses so much.
He's afraid of horses.
He's afraid of horses. Do you like... You're pro-horse, aren't you?
I'm very pro-horse.
You commissioned the piece, didn't you?
I did commission the piece. I think it's a lovely piece.
It's a lovely cover we've got out of it. We've
piece.
Got a lovely picture of a cowgirl on a horse, which is very beautifully shot. We've also got Eamon Duffy on the Reformation, Michelle Pridmore-Brown on that thorny question of how men get old. You can visit our website, the-tls.co.uk, to read it all and learn more about our print and digital subscriptions there. And do come back daily to the site for new original pieces from TLS writers, including, we've got a little mini-series on how Trump may bring peace or chaos to countries like Syria, Israel and China. We've tried to do the thing where we might commission people who might not just say how awful Trump is.
Striving for balance.
Striving. It's very hard to do. I was talking to another editor about that, and it's really hard to get good people to write something that's not just, he's awful.
Mm.
but we may have done that. Paul Thompson has written on the ethics of genetic modification, and our 20 questions come from Michael Chabon, who thinks Odin makes Jehovah look like a whiny, pissant, Trumpian toddler man. His words. He also doesn't like Fanny Price or Esther Summerson either. Someone else didn't like Fanny Price. Devaney Loza didn't like.
Oh, she didn't, but Ben Markowitz did. Yeah.
So she's divisive.
Goes on. Yeah. Goes on.
Where do you stand on the great Fanny Price debate, which we now appear to be having?
I think I've said this. I think I quite liked her if she could be read as a self, a kind of a self-questioning, a satirical persona. Yeah. I think she's quite interesting. She's certainly not my least favourite character.
No, isn't it interesting? She's. I would never have had her down as this divisive figure, but there you go. The great thing about 20 questions is it's amazing how we've now done about 20 or 30 of them. Mm-hmm. And it's people want to have a go at the Victorian kind of Austin or Victorian greats, and lots of
Dickens. It's the stuff that they've been told, you can't question the greatness of this.
Yeah.
I wonder if we'll ever get anyone coming on and saying, you know that Shakespeare, I just can't. I can't be getting on with Shakespeare.
Well, you say that, Thea, but Michael the Dr. Keynes, our Shakespearean expert.
Oh, yes, of course.
He did Shakespeare was overrated. Yeah. I'm crestfallen about that.
I think that's still somewhere in our archive.
Yeah,
we recorded it, didn't we?
And he said Shakespeare was like, I'll move on, it's too sad. You can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and do review us on iTunes. Do join us next week where we shall be celebrating, if that is the right word, which it isn't, 100 years of the Russian Revolution.
No party poppers. Sorry.
No, it'll be...
Not even any cheese.
No, we'll have no worker's cheese to get through it. Until next time, from Thea and from me, goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.